And welcome to Through the Pinard, your conversational podcast talking to midwives around the world about the research they are doing to improve midwifery practice. This research can range from small quality improvement programs and projects to those starting, partway through, or just finishing their postgraduate studies, and to those that have been there, done that, and got the t-shirt. So settle back and enjoy the conversation. And remember, you can continue the conversation on Twitter after you finish listening. Thank you for joining me today. As usual, I'm going to get you to introduce yourself, please.
Okay, hello. My name is Elizabeth Glyn-Jones. I'm a community midwife in Powys in Wales. And I'm really at the very start of my research journey in midwifery. And we've just completed a big research study into father's needs and wants regarding maternity services and how to support them. And we're just in the process of writing it up, and hopefully we'll get some of that published. And I really kind of fell into this role, I've managed to get one day a week paid for by my trust to do some more research as well. So how I started was we had been running some support groups for mums with mild postnatal depression, mums that didn't need sort of great deal of input, but just a bit of support. And that was through our local Mind, the mental health charity. And as part of that, some of the partners had come along and for a one-off session to talk about how they could support their wives, their partners. And most of the men were saying, but where's our course? Where's our dad's course for supporting men and talking about how difficult it was to be a father, and you know, the life changes that some of them had expected and some of them hadn't. And from that, it kind of fed into my consultant midwife and also the local Mind facilitator getting their heads together and putting an application in for some funding to run a project to see, you know, exactly what it is that men want from maternity services. So they wanted another midwife to join in with that, and I said, oh yes please, and got involved that way. And it's been amazing, and the men who came were very open in their conversations, and we ended up having 15 men in three different cohorts talking about how it is to be a dad and currently, and how they felt about it and their mental health and, you know, changes in their relationship and what they wanted from maternity services and how we needed to include them more and support them more. And some of it was quite brutal, some of the things they said. And so from that, I just found it all so fascinating that I've been encouraged again by my consultant midwife to begin a master's, and I'm just started that this last 2 weeks.
Congratulations.
And thank you. And I never thought I'd be doing this. I came to midwifery late, having had my children, you know, earlier. I think I was 40 when I started my training. And I just wanted to be a midwife, just wanted to be a community midwife. And over the years, I've just found that there are other opportunities, and sometimes you just have to take them. And I think it's really important that midwives are producing the evidence base for our practice, and we're not just relying on, you know, lecturers or the obstetric fraternity. That the evidence is coming from us, qualitative and quantitative. And my trusts have been very interested in supporting these sort of small scale research projects.
Yeah.
But we've now just started being part of the pan COVID research that's worldwide. So that looks at pregnancy and neonates that have been affected by coronavirus. So it's eligible for any woman who has had a positive test or even thinks that they might have been positive back sort of earlier in the year before we were properly testing. And then we'll follow them through for 2 years to see if there's any long-term effects. So that's really interesting to be part of something much bigger, even if in rural Wales, our numbers will be quite small. And also there's other opportunities coming along. We will be part of a breastfeeding peer support research group. Some of these things we're not running ourselves, we're just going to be part of as sort of a separate entity of a larger research project. But the whole process has been very exciting and just given me another sort of part of my role to think about, I suppose.
And as you said, the critical importance of understanding that midwives, regardless of where you're working, can actually be a part of producing the evidence which we need to show that we do evidence-based practice. And a lot of the times it is the midwives who are working clinically that can see gaps or have questions of why do we do this way? Why do we need to, or how can we do this better? That those gaps and questions become bigger things when you're able to have the exploration and be able to think about it. Oh, well, let's explore it this way. And the multi-site research adds power to the result findings because it's not just in one central location. You've got happening in multiple different places, which is very exciting to be a part of.
Yeah, exactly. And also, you know, I think it shows that it's not just the big sort of organizations in a big teaching hospital that have relevance to those issues, because we are, as I said before, a very small midwifery led birth center based provision in rural Wales, which is, you know, the distances I have to travel sometimes, I don't compare to, I'm sure, to yours, but in Australia, but rural Australia. But yes, we sort of do 3 or 4 visits a day sometimes outside of coronavirus. And we still have something to say. We still have something to give to these projects. And it's very important that our issues are taken into consideration when deciding about care or making changes to something, and also that our women's voices are heard and men's voices, you know, our families' voices are heard. Very important.
Absolutely. And I think that when you look at a lot of studies that come out, when you go beyond just reading the abstract and actually look at the details within the studies and you start looking at the sample population, then with a lot of studies that it can be too easy to keep to the metros because that's where you've got a larger proportion. And the regional and rural populations, it takes more work to involve them because of distances. It takes more time to involve them because of distances. But they also have very different access to some services in some countries and some kind of like regions. So it's really important that if we're looking at holistic care for the whole community, that we do make sure that we capture the rural voice and the regional voice, because they have, exactly, dropping down and seeing a midwife, if you've got concerns about feeling kind of like fetal movement, is a lot easier when in a city. It can be kind of like a half an hour, less than half an hour to go into a hospital and get checked out. But if you're in the rural area, depending on which country you're in, it can be anywhere from here, like a 6-hour drive, or you've got to wait for the flying doctor to kind of come in, or you've still got to go through in the middle of winter, you've got treacherous roads that you've got to go through covered in snow that will delay that and add stress to it. So I think being involved is brilliant.
I agree. And I think midwives tend to feel that research is something done by other people, and that unless you're doing a PhD or you have contacts with a university or you work in a big teaching hospital who will have probably a research team, that it's not applicable to you. But my experience shows that that's not true. It takes support from management, I would say, to have that kind of vision. But I really believe that we all have something to offer in terms of, even if it's very small studies, and quite specific things as well, maybe.
And I think a lot of midwives possibly don't realise they're doing research because the word research scares them away. But I think if you're doing any quality improvement activity within even just your local kind of like group practice, if you've kind of worked out or something you want to try and you've evaluated it before, you've got your benchmark, you make a change, you evaluate it afterwards, that is research. That's exploring the issue. So yeah, I think that's kind of really cool. Always asking questions and actually saying, I've got this good idea, who can help me? And
support it. I mean, it does take money. It does take funding. I mean, just sort of like, you know, paying for my time and her time is important. And we were lucky we had access to some funding. But writing those funding proposals can seem quite dry, but actually I found it quite interesting. I mean, my part in it was quite small, I suppose. But and then having to go through the process of ethical approval and things. These are all important things to learn how to do if you're doing research, obviously. But and they take time, and I think possibly can be a bit off-putting if you're not used to writing in that way as well, and you might need to get some support for things like that. But they're well worth doing, because once you've done a few, you kind of know what they're expecting, and you know how to write something or how to improve on writing something for the next one. And we've also applied for funding for research that we've got through to the second stage but then been disappointed. So, you know, it's a bit of a knockback, but then you try and think, well, how can I do this a different way or apply for funding from a different pot of money. I just would like to encourage more midwives to just get involved and have a go, and you know, have a chat with a research midwife, even if it's not where you work. Maybe there's somebody sort of local, and don't be too frightened of it, because it is vital that we are the ones who are producing the evidence for our practice.
Absolutely. And there was a really good Twitter discussion through the PhD midwives Twitter handle about how midwifery research is seen. Is it seen as its own field? And within a lot of countries, it's still kind of subsumed under nursing research.
Yeah.
But we're slowly, thankfully, down here in Australia and New Zealand, we've been able to recognise midwifery as a separate, we've got our separate coding for it, but it took a lot of championing from a lot of the senior midwife researchers and professors to get that accepted. And I think slowly, as we produce more of our own research, we will get recognised within our own unique discipline. And especially when we look at the differences between qualitative and quantitative, there's still that assumption that qualitative is lesser quality than quantitative, which drives me nuts. But we've got some fantastic clinical trials that are coming out that are multidiscipline, but are also having some midwives who are leading it. So we've got some fantastic clinical and research midwives who are leading these big quantitative. So that has to be able to improve the reputation, which is cool. So looking at your master's, so what are you going to be, are you going to be using this, or are you going to be kind of branching out and extending this for your master's?
I might be using some elements. The master's is work-based learning. So basically each module I can adapt to what I need it to be within my work as it stands at the moment. So there are quite a few exciting things coming up within my trust. So probably in some kind of extension of this research that we've been writing, will be involved in that, I'm thinking. I'm really interested in kind of like that perinatal mental health subject involving mums and dads, birth trauma as well, as a, you know, and how to mitigate that is another area I'm interested in. So I think like I say, I've just started the master's, but it does seem to be quite adaptable to whatever I want it to be. The focus can be whatever I want it to be. You know, I don't really know as I've just started.
That's okay. And it's almost like being a kid in a candy store. You've got so many options that you have to narrow it down to. But having something that you can do that complements your daytime job is, I think, critical for that mindset, because you can actually then, you don't have that dissonance, I can't even speak at the moment, that kind of like split mind where you've got your daytime job and then you're doing something completely different for your study. Yeah. Some people work that way. But if you can do them both, then you can see the results probably a little bit faster as well.
And I think if it's something, I think most midwives are quite practical people. I think it's the whole package for me. It's the holistic care of the family, particularly the mum and baby, obviously, but it's thinking about the whole family, and it's the practical aspects, but it's the sort of, it's that relationship. It's the theories behind it. It's everything. It's so important. Our role is so important, isn't it? And you know, we can be the thing that encourages and supports and empowers women. And if it's mishandled, we can be the thing that actually breaks them. And that's a terrible responsibility, really. And we have, you know, a huge trust placed in us when women come under our care. And so for it to make it into something that's really relevant to my practice is more important to me than learning sort of theories behind things. Although that's also interesting. But
there's a lot of reading coming up, an awful lot of reading coming up. What do you want? So looking at the study that you're doing with becoming dads and supporting the needs of fathers, and I've seen that there's a couple of presentations that you've done within the last kind of like, well, month when we're recording this, but possibly kind of like a couple of months by the time this airs, that you've presented online, which is one of the advantages of it living in a COVID world at the moment, is that a lot of presentations are virtual and therefore available to be seen. So what do you want people to take out of that research? What, like you said, that some of the feedback from the men were quite brutal. Can you give some examples?
There were some cases of, say, the men in the birthing room being completely disregarded and ignored, not involved in care. There was one man who said they had a home visit after the baby was born, and he was really quite worried about his wife, and I think she did develop postnatal depression, and nobody was really taking any notice of him, and a midwife came and asked his mother-in-law questions about the baby rather than asking him. And just that assumption that he hadn't been around and he wasn't involved, even though he was. And just that they really felt a lot of the time, not necessarily by the community midwives, but sometimes it was. But sometimes if they had to sort of transfer from midwifery-led care to consultant care because something wasn't going quite right, just the whole process of that, things weren't explained very well to them. And a lot of them were suffering a kind of postnatal PTSD, I'd say. But also a lot of the men hadn't really kind of understood what would happen in the birth room. That was one thing, which you know, midwives need to be aware of. And they didn't feel the midwife was there for them, which to a certain extent we're not. I mean, midwife means with women, so, you know, doesn't mean with dad, but we have to include them. We have to encourage them. And I think there's been more and more discussion and there's more understanding of postnatal depression in fathers now as well. So the simplest thing, like when the midwife visits, is just ask him how he is, you know, ask him as well as, you know, we're doing mum's blood pressure and all those things, but just say, and how are you and how are you coping? And some men just wanted that opportunity to be asked and to be able to say, actually, I'm finding it a bit tough. And knowing who to turn to. The support networks as well were important to them, because I think a lot of men not really sure who to talk to, and a lot of the men said they don't talk about these things with their friends. You know, they might go to the pub to watch a football or whatever, but they don't talk about these issues.
That's common for a lot of mental health with men's issues, isn't it? We're trying to find ways to get rid of that stigma. It's interesting listening to and we do see it, the unconscious bias that we can have where, yes, we're with women, but if you're looking at women-centred care, then that should also encompass things that support that woman to kind of, going through that. We have something here that I don't know, well, I don't know how it's going in post-COVID worlds, but we had bubs and beers. So there were some men's support groups that basically was men going to the pub with their babies and actually just sitting and meeting in a side room and talking about them. And it was led by male midwives and or men peer support. So is there any programs like that there?
Yeah, there are. Not in our area, sadly, which we are hoping to change. But there are, especially in the sort of more urban areas. I know there's been a lot of work done in Bristol and also Manchester with some dads groups there. The men in our study said what they would like is to have separate time, not in a pub, but which was quite interesting, to have a sort of peer support group. So there would be somebody there who would be educated in support needs of the men, but who was a dad, who was like, they called him the chief daddy, who was...
That's excellent, chief daddy.
You know, someone who's maybe a little bit older, who's experienced and has got that lived experience, that's really important. Someone who'd have a bit of kudos, but also possibly have a midwife along to these groups as well, so that someone available they could ask sort of questions about, well, how does this happen in the birth room, or, you know, what happens to this? And that someone who had lived experience with this, that, you know, being the support, but who also knew all the details of where to refer people on to if necessary. So that's a very interesting prospect. So we're kind of looking into that a bit further.
So especially with looking at the news reports at the moment, and a lot of countries, Northern Hemisphere countries, are looking to go back into shutdown, partial kind of full lockdown possibly rolling lockdowns, depending on how this COVID world exists. Is that going to be something that you might think needs to be online for the next 6 months, 12 months?
Yes. I mean, I think the particularly the Local Mind charity have started. We've got one of the dads from our groups actually is a trained volunteer with Mind, and he's doing one-to-ones either virtually or on the phone with people. And we're looking into doing a bit more, maybe a virtual once a month meeting for new and prospective dads to join in, just to try and cushion the blow a bit of the distances. It's so difficult with coronavirus. You can't make relationships in the same way, can you, online? But and I think a lot of people will be feeling lonely over the winter, particularly with, you know, as you said, local lockdowns. Wales is going into another local lockdown on Friday for 2 weeks, so it's going to be very tricky for some people, especially if they're worried about, you know, the work and the financial commitments that they are the men particularly said that they felt a huge responsibility when their partners had a baby, and didn't want to worry their partners about it, so took on a lot of that responsibility, and then they've got, you know, the responsibility of looking after her or supporting her. So yeah, I think they definitely are going to need something, and we're looking into doing possibly something once a month at least.
I was reading something the other day that was looking at the timing of postnatal depression in men, and I can't remember the authors, and I really should find it. If I find it, I'll connect it to the link in this podcast. But they were talking about how they were finding that some men's postnatal depression was actually delayed if their wife had postnatal depression. So they were so focused on helping her through it and that transition period. And then once she was okay, then I think they basically crumbled then, or they allowed themselves, and that's when they were seeking help. So the whole focus was on helping their wife and helping, kind of like looking after the baby, depending on how bad her postnatal depression got. And I wonder whether we're going to see more of that because of what you've just said. We're going to have Northern Hemisphere is coming into winter, that you've got increased depression in winter anyway. You've got now local lockdowns and wider lockdowns that are they're going to be occurring over the next 6 months. That if that is going to be something that we will see more of over the next kind of year.
Sadly, I think you're right. You know, I think mental health in general over coronavirus is delicate, isn't it? And I think we need to be thinking and planning accordingly. And I suspect that research is correct, because, you know, men sort of keep it all together for as long as they can and then can only crumble afterwards. And that's the sad thing, is that sometimes the men who find it difficult are the ones that leave. Mm. And that's really, you know, supporting families and women, as you said, women-centered care is not what we want at all, is it? It's supporting them to be the dad that they want to be and they should be, and stay and be part of the children's lives. I think there is some research showing that men who have postnatal depression, their teenage daughters are more likely to have depression. So, you know, there's this knock-on effect all the time if we don't support families well enough.
And that similar effect, that, and that's the intergenerational effect of that, has been proven with veterans. And I know they did a study on Vietnam veterans that looked at the male Vietnam veterans and looked at their children, and both their male and female children had increasing chance of them having PTSD and also issues with drugs and alcohol. And so we know that that changes and affects, we know it changes and affects relationships and the relationship you kind of go up with, and a whole pile of attachment theories that also affect that next generation and how they then have and relate to relationships, but also their parenting style as well. So it is, it's a critical thing that we need to get better at doing and addressing, because quite literally our future depends on it.
Exactly. And the thing is, you know, as children, we all kind of assume everybody's family is the same as ours, and our normal is what everybody's is. And then it's only when you know, you get older that you realize that's not true. And that's the same with relationships. And, you know, so the men in our study were saying that sometimes they're actively trying not to be the kind of father that their father was, either through experience or through meeting their partner, or they've realized, you know, that wasn't the best way to be a dad. And they don't want to follow that same pattern of behavior. So they're actively trying to be different. And other ones thought their father was, you know, absolutely the best kind of father and were trying to follow that pattern. So, you know, in all ways, they were trying to do their best, which is, we just want to help them to do that, don't we, really?
And yeah, absolutely. And sometimes they don't know that's an issue until they become a dad, because it has been, and I know with a friend who has had a horrible kind of growing up, but it really, he knew what wasn't good, but it didn't really hit him until he became a dad. And then suddenly it was like, I need to go speak to someone about this. I need to sort this out, because I don't want this to, and I think his words were, I don't want this to infect my daughter.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that kind of catalyst was like, oh no, I can put it away. Yeah, I can tinker it. But now it's like, actually, no, there's real consequences. I need to deal with this, because otherwise it will have effects on her. So you're starting your master's. So what are some of the things that because with people who are doing further into their studies, I ask them what advice and wisdom can they give? What concerns have you got about doing your postgrad studies? What are you kind of, what's those little nervous butterflies that are tinkering away?
I suppose time is my biggest worry. Will I have time to do it all? It's a part-time master's over 3 years. So it's one module this semester and one module next semester. And I'm hopeful that I will have the time. But, you know, sometimes life gets in the way. I've got a family and my parents aren't getting any younger. And, you know, just work things that happen. I also I'm on call twice a week for women who are birthing, so yeah, there's a lot of things that can get in the way. So I've really had to sort of, you know, think about how I'm going to allocate time specifically for this and look at my strengths and weaknesses and not leave everything to the last minute. I am pretty motivated, I have to say. So it's just working out how that's all going to fit in with me. And then a slight concern, can I write at a good enough level for a master's? Yep. You know, I think if I'd gone straight from a degree, I would have been okay, but it's been a few years. So I've got to get kind of back into the swing of things, but doing this, the dad's research has helped, because I've had to write to, you know, a sort of to an academic level for that, and just, it's just picking up those skills that you had before, making sure they're still there, kind of thing. And I'm not getting any younger, and my memory is shocking.
I can understand that, absolutely understand that. So are you going to be able to have the same supervisors for the whole of your master's, or is it you'll have a different person for each of the topics that you're doing?
I think at the moment it's going to be the same tutor for the first year, and we can choose a practice facilitator, so that's somebody who we work with, who can oversee. So I've actually chosen my consultant midwife because she's already done this course a few years ago.
Oh,
So,
good.
and she knows me well, and she's very good at, pushing me into things that I maybe wouldn't have thought of doing. So yeah, she's been very supportive of my plans.
Which is critically important to have somebody who can push you when you need it, be honest with you, but also be supportive as well.
Yeah, definitely. And also sort of the environment. Someone the other day said to me, why are you doing this, Liz? I was like, well, it's a challenge, and sometimes we need a challenge to make us realize what we can achieve. It's not going to be easy, and I'm very lucky my partner's very supportive as well.
That makes life a whole lot easier because it is going to be. I ended up calling my masters my mistress because I kept feeling like I was running away and spending time with her. And it was just kind of like thinking, oh, it's time for my mistress again, and kind of like everything else gets pushed to the side. So what are you going to do to make sure you find that elusive balance between, I was going to say, well, work, rest, and play, but work, study, and sanity?
I'm quite lucky in that I have been given some paid study days that I can choose to fit in with when I need to be on. But most of it is by virtual teaching and planning and things. So that will fit in. I'll have to make sure that that fits in, hopefully, with the rest of my work, and just be very disciplined, I think. And plan things ahead, so I'm not leaving things to the last minute.
Yeah, adrenaline rush is helpful, but not necessarily the best for postgraduate studies.
Not always, no. And I think it's just being methodical about things.
Yep. So you're going to looking at publishing this, the paper on becoming dads, hopefully over the next kind of wee while, depending on how that goes. And you're looking at being involved in the breastfeeding study and the pan-COVID study. You're going to be busy.
Yeah. I
Which
know.
is
That's okay.
good, because I think if you've got that, if something excites your passion and you've got that interest, it's easier to get involved in things and to prioritize things. It's when you're not enjoying it, and I think that's one of the biggest things you hear people say when they're choosing a topic for PhD studies in particular, is choose something you passionately believe in, because you're going to be living with it for kind of like intensely for either a full-time or part-time load. And I think that with research as well, when you're looking at research, the more that you have a passion for it and it lights your fires and you can see the reason why you're doing it and how it's going to change, then that's easier to get other people excited about it too. And you become one of those, dare I say, change champions, but people who excite others to question how they're doing things.
Yeah, I think you're right. I went to a recent study day. In fact, it wasn't that recent, it was last summer, about breech birth, and the whole team were amazingly passionate about it, and it's something that also excites me. But it was amazing to see them, and they're doing some really good work in London. I forget which hospital, sorry. But it's vital that you're getting this information again from midwives, and you can see the passion in the whole team in supporting women to have vaginal breech births, and working out the safest way of doing that, and supporting obstetricians as well, because it's a skill that's being lost. So that passion, you know, can rub on to other people, rub off on other people, and change practice. So yes, I think that's vital as well.
That's the kind of the type of infectious kind of action that we'd like, rather than this COVID stuff we're going through.
Definitely.
So one of the things that kind of like most of the people I'm talking about have got a Twitter handle, so that will be posted as well when the podcast goes up. So if people want to continue the conversation with you, then I encourage them to do that using your Twitter handle. And I also encourage people to kind of get involved and ask about what's happening around their area, and if they've got a passion interest area, to seek out the people who are doing the research in it, who are talking about it, and be involved in those conversations, because you never know, as you said, what sparks an interest.
Yeah, perfect. So my Twitter handle is Liz Bump Lover, which I chose when I was a student. So
I was going to ask about the story behind that, because I love it.
I can't remember quite how it came about. I was at a conference with a very good, very dear midwifery friend of mine, and she said, "Oh, let's join Twitter." And I just couldn't really think of anything, and I thought, "Oh, I can't say pregnancy lover or something like that." I don't know. It wasn't well thought out.
But you know what? It needs to be unique. And I mean, mine's kind of just academic Liz, so kind of a little bit boring, but it describes me. And I think that it needs to be something that makes you laugh, or is something that describes you.
Or people will remember, I suppose.
People will remember, absolutely. It's like, oh, Liz Bump. Oh, that's right. Easier to remember and easier to find. Thank you for your time. It has been fabulous speaking with you.
Thank you very much for asking me.
Thank you for joining us today. You'll find all the links on Twitter, Instagram, and on the podcast website. If you are a midwife and you would like to share your research, your postgraduate studies, or even the quality improvement projects you are doing now, then email me at throughthepinard@gmail.com. Send me a tweet or send me a DM.